blend of stream of consciousness expression. It's not bad. Sex, children, work, beauty, ecstasy, death, regeneration. That's The Turning Point, every Monday at 4 p.m. Eastern on PRN.FM. The Progressive Radio Network is moving forward, and we hope you're coming with us. Now, you don't have to come with us, but what would the neighbors say?
This is the number one radio station for progressive independent thinkers, the Progressive Radio Network.
Live from New York City, it's the Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null. Nice to have you with us today. We're going to talk about health and healing. For example, dietary potassium, more than what you would get in a banana, you need about 1,000 milligrams a day, will help alleviate hardening of the arteries, according to new study. And that nutrient that those who are very aware of good nutrition use, chlorella, C-H-L-O-R-E-E-L-L-A, that can help ward off the post-exercise infections, especially the lung. And vitamin K1 deficiency is linked to heart enlargement, especially in younger people who don't get vitamin K1 in any case. We have a lot to share on health and healing today. And then beyond that, we're going to take a look at the environment, the latest environmental issues and news, and I'm going to address an issue that's come up on several occasions, just last night in a lecture, being one of them, about the good old days. And indeed, I'm sure all of us remember times in life where it was better in different ways, but I'm going to use a larger brush for stroking this out. I'm going to show you what the good old days were for most of the people on the planet, including Americans. And I'm just going to maybe take one day in China and where else? Italy, England, United States. What would it have been like for a settler? And then put that in perspective, especially if you're living in New York City, and more than 50% of the people living in New York City are living below the poverty line. We're talking about millions of people. So they're really struggling because all of Manhattan and Brooklyn in particular are in a bubble. Rents are skyrocketing. The prices of different things are increasing. How do these people survive? And do they have their options? And because some people celebrate Columbus Day, I thought it would be important to allow some Native Americans. Everyone you're going to hear is a Native American. In hopefully one or two words, describe what Christopher Columbus means to them. Something different, right? Let's begin. From the University of Technology in Sydney, if you smoke during pregnancy, you have a higher probability of having in your infant cerebral palsy. And scientists investigating the underlying mechanisms causing cell death and damage have confirmed now links between maternal smoking and cerebral palsy, which is the most common physical disability in childhood. And it's very simple. When you smoke, you're using up oxygen, and there's simply not enough oxygen in the blood that reaches the developing brain, and it causes a hypoxia, ischemic injury. And that reduces the well-being of the cellular powerhouse, the mitochondria. That causes oxidative stress, and this leads to increased cell death in the offspring's brain. And cerebral palsy, or cerebral palsy, is caused by increased cell death in several brain regions that regulate movement and memory retention. A lot of people have it, so simply don't smoke. That's the simplest explanation there. And then we have a University of Edinburgh in Scotland. They wanted to know, is it all in the genes why people are fat? And they found, no, it is not. In fact, the lifestyle differences are what's responsible for various obesity or overweight rates, at least in Scotland. I'm sure it is also the same around other parts of America. And they state right here that genetic factors cannot be the sole blame for all this, as historically it has been. Now, what would that mean? Well, let's just give you an example. Even in the United States, in the Southwest, you tend to eat the very spicy food. Lots of jalapeno peppers, a strong influence from the influence of people who live close to the land. You're more likely to use yucca, more likely to use cactus. Cactus, by the way, south of the border is very common. Now here, we would never eat a cactus. You don't see it on the menus. But down there, they simply take a cactus leaf and they scrub it so that little tiny hair follicles that can puncture your skin and certainly puncture your tongue are wiped out. They then, generally, they'll cut it into thin strips, boil it for a little bit, and then they saute it, generally with lots of garlic and peppers and salt. And that's how it's served. Well, that's low in calories. And it's different than if you were having a so-called New England boiled dinner, where the emphasis is heavy on root vegetables like potatoes and meat. And that has way more calories. Now, then if you came from where I came from, West Virginia, it's a unique diet. It's, well, Kentucky, Tennessee, West Virginia, Ohio, all are merging states. They are all right on the Ohio River. Several of them are right across from each other. You take a bridge from one and you're in the other. So you have commonly shared themes about food. If you live in the country, it was very common for people to eat rabbit and squirrel and possum. And if you went into anyone's home, they'd been eating possum. The whole house stunk. By the way, possum is one animal, A, you shouldn't eat. And for no other reason, even if you're a meat eater, because it eats more ticks than any other creature on earth. And they're immune to Lyme's disease. So a possum is a good thing to have to eat all the ticks on your property. And in any case, you tend to be eating catfish. Everybody goes down to the Kanawha River, which was always muddy as can be, and it intersects the Ohio River, which is not muddy, but the Ohio River had all the chemical, like DuPont factories on it, and you knew that was getting in the water and the whole air sunk. But the Kanawha is where everyone would pull up the big catfish and then they would eat catfish. Catfish is very fat, very high in calories, not a healthy fish to eat. It's a bottom feeder. But that's what people's staples were. So that would give you a tendency to be more overweight. And people generally overate. That whole idea, you got to sit at a table and eat everything on the plate. Well, what if you put too much food on the plate to begin with? Well, most people did. And most of the time, your potato was a mashed potato with cream in it and then gravy. And gravy is simply coagulated blood with flour. They put a completely nutritionally worthless flour. They put salt and pepper in it, and then they put blood in there, pig's blood or cow blood, and heat it, and it bubbles up. It's really gross to watch. It smells like I haven't. But if nobody's seeing how it's being made in the kitchen, which they aren't, and then they get a roll, which is, again, more refined carbohydrate, well, there tends to be a lot of obesity because you're not eating much fresh food. Whereas if you go to more tropical areas where the diet is heavy in fish and fruit, that's where you tend to be leanest. So we are going to be directly impacted, if you're the average person, by how people eat in different areas. And now you got a whole new factor of that if you're a younger person, most of your food is either sent in, pizzas or chicken wings, or you eat out. None of it's healthy. And there's not a whole lot of activity, so sedentary activity increases obesity. So you can be the person who's different. You can be the lean person in a family that's overweight. You can be the person eating healthy, even if they kind of mock and laugh at you. But at the end of the day, you can control your weight, and that gives you a big chance to live a longer life and be less susceptible to heart attack, stroke, and diabetes. The American Academy of Nutrition and Dietetics came out with an idea that plant-based foods, which are very rich in fiber, are finally being recognized as being good. There's two ways of looking at it. First, you say, well, that's good, because we know the more fiber you have in your diet, the less constipated you're going to be, and the less constipation, the cleaner your body, the lower your cholesterol with more fiber. Fiber reduces cholesterol. And also, by reducing cholesterol, especially the LDL, you're reducing risk of heart disease, obesity, and diabetes. So something as inexpensive and easy to get into the diet as fiber makes a big difference. But did it mean that it didn't make a difference before this study was published? That truth only begins when it's scientifically confirmed, or does reality supersede scientific verification? Well, it's a self-evident statement. Of course, we have reality. Then we have trying to prove that reality has a scientific or reductionist base. There's nothing more pathological in a society than making everything reduced to a common denominator. And that means you deny faith, prayer, beliefs, higher power, mysteries of universal energy exchange. All that is denied. You get right. Everything has got to be reduced to a molecular fine point. Wow. And you wonder why we have so many people so certain of life and so clueless about it. So get your fiber and live a longer life. I think that we should be feeding our bodies more pumpkin seeds and pumpkin butter. Now, butter is not from dairy. Pumpkin butter, like sesame butter and sunflower butter and chia butter, is simply where you take the seed and you grind it until it's no longer fibrous. And it's delicious. And in the refrigerator last 2 years. Well, these are the edible seeds. And all edible seeds. And by the way, guess what is the most nutritious of all the edible seeds? Watermelon. In fact, watermelon is one of nature's most perfect foods. It's the food to cleanse. It's one of the most important foods if you have pain in your joints. If you want to get a good flush, watermelon helps do that. And it's delicious, especially when it's cold and it's hot outside and the watermelon's cold. It's just scrumptious. In any case, what they have found is that now they're looking at the actual science of pumpkin, and they're finding that it has a lot of potassium, manganese, magnesium, copper, zinc. It has a lot of amino acids, which is our protein, and it's good for anemia because it's rich in iron. So it's really good for you. So what does a pumpkin seed do once it goes into the body? It can help a lot. It's good for prostate. It's very good because pumpkin seed oil has been studied for its ability to inhibit testosterone-induced prostate growth. So for all the men in the audience who have a problem with prostate, pumpkin seed oil can help you because it can help reduce the causative factor in benign prostatic hyperplasia. It's also been proven safe and effective compared to the drug Prozacin. It also is great for women suffering from postmenopausal symptoms. If you took 2,000 milligrams, which is just 2 grams of pumpkin seed oil, it can reduce blood pressure, hot flashes, headaches, joint pain. That's all good. It can reduce blood pressure and lipid abnormalities lower than what you could do almost with anything else. So that's important. It also has an ability on the calcium oxalate kidney stones. According to a study that I saw in the American Journal of Clinical Nutrition, children with calcium oxalate crystals in their urine responded very favorably to the supplementation in their diet with pumpkin seeds. It's also good for cardiovascular and liver disease. If you mix in equal amounts flax seeds and pumpkin seeds, let's say a tablespoon of both, that's not much, that can have heart protective and liver protective properties. That was published in the Journal of Food Chemistry and Toxicology. It's also good for arthritis. Pumpkin seed oil was found to compare favorably with the non-steroidal anti-inflammatories and in arthritis. This was published in Pharmacological Research. It has been able to lower blood pressure, the pumpkin seed oil. It's very good for parasites, especially if you have dogs and cats. It's good, the pumpkin seeds, because it can work against canine intestinal parasites. And it's even good if you have insomnia. Pumpkin seeds contain high levels of tryptophan, about 22 milligrams per gram of pumpkin seed protein, and that's the amino acid precursor to serotonin, which itself converted to melatonin, the sleep hormone, in the evening. So all these reasons, it's really good for male pattern baldness. In fact, there was a randomized, double-blind, placebo-controlled trial published in Evid-based Complementary Alternative Medicine found that men receiving pumpkin seed oil saw up to a 40% increase in hair counts, while the placebo group showed, 5%. So, pumpkin seed oil can help reverse balding. And if you have an overactive bladder, if you have urinary disorders, a clinical trial found that pumpkin seed oil at 10 grams, that's not a lot. Remember, you got 28.35 grams to an ounce. So you're not even talking about a little over a quarter of an ounce. All right, that's a small amount. Taken for 12 weeks was safe and effective, reducing overactive bladder. So just the latest on it. And one final thing from the University of Virginia, antibiotic use weakens the immune system's ability to fight off disease. How many times have we seen a person give a round of antibiotics that they did? And easily could have been done with other non-aggressive therapies like garlic or black cumin oil or wild oregano oil. But they didn't. And then they ended up dying from an infection. So now there has been a rising tide of awareness regarding the dangers of overusing antibiotics. Not only are viruses developing antibiotic resistance at an alarming rate, new research out of the Virginia School of Medicine has found that antibiotic use can also make the gut microbiome and the immune system more prone to disease. And they believe it's due to a reduction in the positive gut bacteria microbes that assist in fighting off disease. So we are using way too many antibiotics, and we shouldn't, because it's really, really dangerous. That's the latest on health and healing. I'm Gary Noll. We're going to take a brief break and come right back. Please stay with us. For those of you who celebrate Columbus Day, that you're right, but who do we never hear from? Who never has had a parade celebrating Columbus? Native Americans. And in the North, in the South, in the very South. South America, Central America, North America, Canada. So we're going to hear just a two-minute clip from people who are giving us their input on Christopher Columbus. Please listen.
Evil. Pure evil. Invader.
He got lost coming here, and he's the one that named us Indians because he thought he was in India. So he's not a good figure to the Native community.
Confused? I don't think we should have a holiday for it.
Pain, claiming North America as like land that could be claimed and could be taken. It's the start of a lot of pain.
Christopher Columbus.
I guess ignorance.
Oh my God, murderer, rapist.
Genocide.
The atrocities committed, just grotesque. And the scars are still felt today.
Evil.
For sure.
It's according to the U.S. government law, it says if you partake in somebody that's stealing, then you're just as guilty. Everybody knows the United States was stolen. So therefore, all those that are original that knows about the genocide, the rape, the murder, the theft, the putting on the reservations on a rock that they couldn't survive on, they're going to have to face judgment.
Murderer.
So those are a few of the thoughts about people concerning Christopher Columbus. And if you study Christopher Columbus's real history and what happened in complete cooperation with the Catholic Church at that time, you'll realize Manifest Destiny, even though it had not, the term had not been coined yet, was in full force. Manifesting destiny, meaning you had God on your side so you couldn't be wrong, and yet look at the consequences to that. I believe that a lot of the reasons we make mistakes today is not because we intend to. I believe most people have good intention with a lot of the things they do. I believe that the problem is in our conditioning. And whatever our beliefs are, that's how we end up manifesting our problems. So what I like to do is to give you some of the background on our conditioning. What can we do about it? How can we change? How can we uncondition ourselves? And what lessons can we learn from the mistakes that we have made? So let's now go to part two of our ongoing series of a University of California psychologist sharing some very profound insights about, wow, at all levels. And by the way, at all levels, we'd like to think that only the uneducated are functionally illiterate about life. No, you can take Professor Emeritus's, you can take Nobel Prize winners, you can take the people who are considered the most esteemed for their knowledge, and they can also be victims of conditioning. Just to put this in perspective, remember back during the Second World War, prior to the extermination camps, in fact, prior to Auschwitz being used as a camp in Poland to kill the Jews, it was used as a camp to kill a communist, to kill political agitators. They were deathly afraid. Hitler was afraid of Stalin. And so anytime they could get people, and they were getting them after they invaded Russia and taking them there for interrogation and killing, over 2 million Russian prisoners of war were killed, frequently given no food whatsoever. They just killed. They didn't even want to use them in their factories. And then they celebrated something that was just horrific, and the American Psychiatric Association did not challenge them because there was a huge eugenic movement in the United States. And it had been the major spokesperson was Margaret Sanger. And she was a avid racist and a eugenicist. Rather ironic that with all the monuments being challenged and the people being vilified for what they've done historically, you would have thought that she would have been one of the very first people, because she believed upwards of 10% of the entire population should be exterminated for society's benefits so that they did not pollute the gene pool. Long before the Germans, and two particular German psychiatrists, got interested in eugenics, it was already a full-blown movement in the United States. But somehow, because of the political politics, people won't touch her. And yet she is right up there, in my opinion, with the worst of the worst because what she was promoting. Don't confuse the implementation and lack of its success with her desire to see feeble-minded people killed, women sterilized. And by the way, we were sterilizing hundreds of thousands of women in the United States. Never those who were successful, wealthy, and white. Never those who came from good families. But if you came from the other side of the tracks, or if you had some other problems, or then yes. And not a word about it. Well, it happened, just like lynchings happened, just like an entire black city I talked about was in Greenwood near Tulsa, Oklahoma, happened. These things actually happened. We may erase them from our memory and textbooks. They still happened. But in Germany, they wanted to experiment about how they could exterminate people. And they didn't want to get it out. So the first people were not killed in the concentration camps. They were taken from the concentration camps into cities in Germany, including Berlin. And they took them to mental institutions. And there, down in the basements, they tried. They first tried with cars, and that didn't work because it wasn't putting enough carbon monoxide in to kill them. Then they tried larger vans, and they tried what were called death vans, where they could kill enough people, and they made it look like a shower. They had shower heads down in the basement, and the people were brought in. And by the way, the people considered mentally ill weren't mentally ill. Most were political prisoners. And then after they were killed, they were put back into that truck and taken out and put into mass graves. And there was a film, and I actually have a clip of it because I'm going to use it in a new film that I've been working on for a long time called Manufacturing Madness, which is a condemnation of the entire psychiatric field and our entire mental health field and every one of the models we're currently using for what represents mental health. In any case, they would take a photograph where they would shine the light down on a person and then film them from underneath, like below their chin, so they would look ghastly, distorted. And they would put them in distorted positions, take pictures, and then they would have newsreels and say, these poor souls should be liberated from this life of agony and pain. So they killed them by the tens of thousands. And all the mental institutions were cleaned out. And that's where they began to use the carbon monoxide before they got to more efficient ways of killing them, which I'll deal with on an upcoming program. Because I don't think people really know how it all operated. All we know is some general overview of a lot of people were killed. I'm going to take you through that. Who was involved, how they did it, how methodical they did it. How could you get up in the morning and play with your children and kiss your wife goodbye and put on your outfit and go out to work without being aware that for you going out to work that day, there were going to be thousands of people condemned or killed. And that was considered normal. What I'm calling that segment that I'm writing now, the good Nazi. They thought they were good people. Well, they were not. But then again, we always justify our extremes. So let's see how those psychiatrists were so indoctrinated themselves, so brainwashed themselves, that they could view anyone who was not considered genetically pure or Aryan less than human. Let's listen to part two.
Bear with semantics has given birth to a new phrase to describe the rich.
Job creators in America basically are on strike.
Increasing taxes on job creators.
This administration and this president, policies are hostile to job creators.
Instead of just saying the wealthy who make over $250,000 a year, if you say job creator, then you say, well, we can't raise their taxes. The other ones are create jobs. When in reality, when their taxes were higher under Bill Clinton, three times as many jobs were created.
The propensity to add softer terms to the English lexicon has surged over the decades, particularly when it comes to military-related language.
Damaging euphemisms, like when, instead of saying innocent civilians were killed in a drone strike, you say there was collateral damage. Collateral damage, which to me is the worst expression. No, it's innocent men, women, and children were killed. And the collateral damage sounds like a real estate transaction.
Allied soldiers shooting each other has become known as
friendly fire.
Kidnapping and transferring a terrorist suspect is called
extraordinary rendition.
And the torture America's war prisoners might endure is referred to as
enhanced interrogation.
Now we're going to start propaganda technique number two. And this sort of builds on itself, but I want to warn you about something. The purpose of propaganda is ultimately to make you feel better about something, about garbage, about killing, about whatever. So as we take off the veils of propaganda and become more media literate, we're starting to look at things that are a little harder to look at. This is really not an entertaining lecture. No pain, no gain here. As we become more conscious of the propaganda in our lives, we have to confront things that propaganda protects us from. Propaganda is kind of like a bandage, and we're pulling that bandage off, so fasten your seatbelts. So, repeated affirmations is essentially this. I'm going to try to tell you that 2 plus 2 is 5, and how am I going to convince you of that? Well, let's say I got Stephen Hawking to talk in his way, in a muffled tone, about the new mathematics which allows 2 plus 2 to be 5. And then I got another a Nobel Prize winner who said, yes, there are conditions under which 2 plus 2 could be 5. And then another speaker and another speaker. And pretty soon it's repeated so much that you start to believe it. Maybe 2 plus 2 is 5 or could be 5. That's what repeated affirmations is. Say the lie over and over again with authority figures, and it starts to be believed. Here's Joseph Goebbels, the propaganda minister of Nazi Germany. Propaganda must therefore always be essential and repetitious. It must confine itself to a few points and repeat them over and over. Okay, thank you, Mr. Goebbels. Now, George Bush said almost exactly the same thing. See, in my line of work, you got to keep repeating things over and over and over to kind of catapult the propaganda. Well, that's exactly what happened with Iraq. But before we talk about Iraq, I need to introduce a psychological term, a delusion. So imagine there's a guy who has a cat, and he sees that his cat went over to his neighbor's house, and the neighbor is feeding his cat. He doesn't like that. He doesn't like his neighbor feeding the cat. He doesn't say anything, but it really makes him mad. And he thinks the neighbor is poisoning his cat. So after a couple months of this, his cat dies. And he is very, very upset. And he believes that that guy, a delusion, by the way, is a false theory about the world, a false idea. Okay. So he, like George Bush, wants to have this cat inspected for weapons of mass destruction. And he sends the cat off to a toxicologist for an autopsy. And it comes back, the cat died of natural causes. Sorry, no poisons, no toxins, no weapons of mass destruction. Then he's not satisfied. He goes for another autopsy and another inspection. The same result, nothing, sorry. No toxins. And he's still not happy, still doesn't believe it. And he finally gets himself so worked up, he walks over to the neighbor's house, confronts him, shoots him, and kills him. Okay? So that's a hypothetical example of a person who is mentally ill, who is suffering from a delusion. Okay? Now, we have that under our belt. So let's now talk about repeated affirmations and the delusions that we had about Iraq. We had two major delusions. First delusion, first false idea, was that Saddam Hussein orchestrated or had some role in the 9/11 attacks on the World Trade Center and the Pentagon. And the second delusion was that Saddam Hussein was developing nuclear weapons. Now, let's not talk about the second because we know that that's false, okay? But we'll talk about the first. The first lie is that Saddam Hussein had a connection with those 9/11 hijackers. Mohammed Atta, the Saudi kingpin of the 9/11 attacks, secretly met with an Iraqi intelligence official in Prague on April 9th, 2001. Oh, yes, he did. And that's the connecting point between 9/11 and Saddam Hussein and Iraq and why we had to invade them. The truth is, that Muhammad Atta was in Sarasota, Florida then. He was making calls on his cell phone on April 6th, April 9th, April 10th, April 11th. He used his ATM card in the United States on April 4th. He was never in Prague. He didn't meet with any intelligence official. But we're trying to say 2 plus 2 is 5 here. And there's a great need to do that. So Bush says, this, talking about Saddam Hussein, this is a man who's got connections to Al-Qaeda. He's a threat because he's dealing with Al-Qaeda. That's because they met in Prague, right? We're taking the fight to those who attacked us, said George Bush. Well, did Saddam Hussein attack us? Did he have anything to do with Muhammad Atta, the 9/11 hijackers? Are we taking the fight to those who attacked us? To Vice President Cheney, he did meet with a senior official of Iraqi intelligence in Czechoslovakia last April, several months before the attack. Czech police said no. The FBI said no. There's no evidence that that happened. Now, you're going to keep repeating that and repeating that and repeating that.
Saddam Hussein aids and protects terrorists, including members of Al-Qaeda.
There was a relationship between Iraq and Al-Qaeda.
Saddam, Al-Qaeda, Saddam, Al-Qaeda,
Saddam, the Al-Qaeda,
Saddam, Saddam,
Saddam,
Al-Qaeda.
It is only a matter of time before terrorist states armed with weapons of mass destruction develop the capability to deliver those weapons to U.S. cities.
What we're giving you are facts and conclusions based on solid intelligence.
Man who hates America. Saddam Hussein aids and protects terrorists.
So, that was just the extent of the propaganda. The big pinnacle was just before we went to a war against Iraq, Colin Powell spoke in front of the UN with a PowerPoint presentation, and the entire mass media went crazy. Pontificating about exactly these two delusions. Paul Wolfowitz, who has also disappeared from our consciousness, he was on 180 times. Bloodthirsty rhetoric about why we needed to go and invade Iraq because they were developing weapons of mass destruction and they were aiding and abetting Al-Qaeda. Now, there were two doves who hardly got any attention at all. One was Scott Ritter. He was an inspector, and he said, there are no weapons of mass destruction, guys. We've inspected and inspected and inspected. The cat died of natural causes, okay? And Noam Chomsky, look at how, this is over a 20-to-1 ratio between hawks and doves, all during this period leading up to the war. Now, here's the delusion that Iraq had something to do with 9/11. Right after 9/11, people were asked about Iraq, and only about 16% felt Saddam Hussein had anything to do with it. But with all of this propaganda coming out, Cheney and all those folks, about 28% believed that Iraq had something to do with it. 2 years after we invaded Iraq, close to 60%, 56% of Americans believed a delusion. Okay, they believed a falsehood. Now, if you watched PBS, that was your major source of information, sorry, PBS viewers did not buy it. If you watched Fox News, close to 60%. I read one study where almost 80% of Fox viewers believed Saddam Hussein had something to do with 9/11 and was making nuclear weapons. Now, 3 years into the war, George Bush is caught off guard at a press conference. A journalist asks him, what did Saddam Hussein have to do with 9/11? Check out his answer.
What did Iraq have to do with what?
The attack on the World Trade Center.
Nothing.
What did Iraq have to do with the attack on the World Trade Center? Nothing. Thanks a lot. Now, 3 years into the war, 90% of U.S. soldiers who were fighting and putting their lives at risk, believed that Saddam Hussein had something to do with 9/11. This is called a delusion. This is called a mental illness, except it wasn't one man with a cat who suffered from a mental illness. It was the majority of the American people, Congress, the Senate, who were duped, who were living in a trance. And we went off to war, and we killed approximately 100,000 people. Now, one of the consequences of a delusion is that you're mentally ill. The man who goes and shot the cat, the man he thought poisoned his cat, he didn't think that that man was married, that he had two sons, that he created a widow, that he deprived these two sons of a father, that the guy also had his own father and mother, a grandpa and grandma, and they lost their son. And he also had a best friend. Have you ever lost your best friend? It's a trauma. It's a tragedy. There are a lot of other people involved in acting out a delusion. Now, some people say we killed 86,000 people.
Tomorrow we'll play the next part of this. And I wanted to play a little bit from the last time because people who later emailed me and said they didn't have a chance to really hear it. I'm showing you each day how we become good citizens. And wasn't it Thoreau who said, I cannot be both a good person or a good citizen? You have to choose which. Because as a person, you begin to look for universal truths. As a citizen, you can become highly nationalistic, you can become highly prejudiced, and you pride yourself on information you do not want penetrating because it may adversely affect or in some way alter the absolute rightness of your own beliefs. And that's how we set the stage for very biased minds. And it's in all areas. I'll give you one example. I was asked once to do a debate with the top doctor for the American Arthritis Foundation, and I did. And on the show, he stated what all rheumatologists have been conditioned and brainwashed to believe, that arthritis was not impacted by anything you would eat or drink, either in the causation or the improvement, meaning nothing that you would eat or drink would cause arthritis or reverse arthritis. Today, even in their own journals, they have repudiated that. They show all kinds of things you eat and drink can cause chemical imbalances and inflammation. But at that time, and for years before that, they were absolutely certain, so certain that they wouldn't even want to speak with someone like myself. I would have been considered so uneducated and so unscientific, and yet now it's been proven we were right on every single major health issue ever that we brought up. They were wrong on every single health issue ever. I debated the U.S. Surgeon General on national television on PBS. The person didn't answer one question correctly. I chose, out of manners, not to make the person look bad. And afterwards, the Surgeon General came over and said, thank you, because I wasn't prepared for this. And I just thought to myself, I didn't say anything. You were prepared. You just had the wrong answers. We're absolutely certain in the legitimacy of synthetic hormone replacement therapy, and yet for every woman taking it, you put her at a big risk of a heart attack, a stroke. You didn't intend that. You wouldn't want that, but that's the consequence. So just understand, if you want to know why medicine doesn't change, our laissez-faire neoliberalism doesn't change, why good Democrats don't change, why good conservatives don't change, why people who promote free speech are engaged in censorship. Even right now, there is, first it was Bill Cosby, and then it was Roger Ailes, and then a couple other people at Fox, and then it was Bill O'Reilly. And it was not just what they had did, it was the fact that they had power or perceived power to cause people to lose their jobs or prevent them from getting work. And I'm thinking to myself, my goodness, right now they have Harvey Weinstein and 30 years, according to the New York Times, of paying off people for sexual harassment or worse. And now he's finally had to come forward, and he was fired from his own company on Sunday. And they'll go from there. Now, I'm sure that because he is a good liberal and support a lot of liberal causes and careers, he will be condemned, but much like Bill Clinton was condemned after, you know, Paula Jones and some of the other people that he assaulted. It will not have the same vitriol or the same consequences as it did with those that they didn't like. And then I'm thinking, if you're on Pacifica and you're listening to them being condemned, and they should be condemned, then why not tell the public, your listeners, how much their money that they gave in fund drives went to pay off sexual harassments from managers and employees at all the stations, some of whom are still employed, were never fired. How do you reconcile that? Could you imagine getting up and saying, today we'd like your funds because our second largest expense outside of salaries is to pay off these sexual suits. And even through the National Labor Relations Board, because I spoke with these people, they won, meaning the person was found guilty of this sexual harassment, but still got to keep their job and is still there today. Wow, the hypocrisy is palpable. But that's the way the world we live in, and part of that is our conditioning. I'll continue that tomorrow. But I want to address something today that I also consider important, and that is, how much do we know about how people actually lived in the past? And don't look for Hollywood or for some of the graphic novels, because they're frequently going to paint a completely different picture than what actually happened. I'll give you an example. Let's just go back to medieval England. All right, good. Now you see it, you know, the Tower of London, you see a Parliament, you see quaint shops. I even go to a place when I go to England, I've been there, I'm guessing, 40 times. There's a place called Neal's Yard, and it's exactly as it was, the bricks in the street, the little stall, back in the 17th century. But the reality was, if I was back there at that time, there was no town sanitation. That meant that everyone in that town went to the bathroom, and there were no running toilets, there was no indoor water, there was no indoor plumbing. So you just passed a bucket around, and everyone went in the bucket, and there was no toilet paper, there's nothing to wipe with, and you just threw what was in the bucket right out the window. Or unless you were at the street level, in which case you opened the door and just threw it out in the street. Now, they did have street sweeps. People would came along with these very rigid brooms, and they would smear it around. Larger debris might get pushed down someplace. But imagine the stench. Oh, by the way, open drain channels also ran along the sides or down the center of streets. So everything that was dead, diseased, or human debris was always where you were walking. Oh, and you had to walk around the pigs because people had a lot of pigs. And if you did get water and you brought it in because that was the only way to get it, you threw the water out the window somewhere in the general vicinity of a drain. Of course, it didn't get in the drain. And there were dire vats where they dyed clothes, leathers, and they were extremely toxic. And they had frequently very toxic dyes in them. And all that got emptied in, you guessed it, to the same street. Every single business would throw whatever was bad out into the street. Pigs, pigs, pigs. Everywhere in medieval England you had pigs. Why? Because they were inexpensive to keep because they could generally go out and eat garbage. And then when you were hungry enough, you'd eat the pig. And it was a primary source of food for them. And they were out 24/7. You know, people might in some way designate their pigs, but pigs are pretty smart. So wherever they're grown up, that's where they'll come back. In the daytime, they run out and wander. But then you say, oh, well, that's how the average person lived if they lived in the city. Yes, life expectancy was short. The diet was very basic. They had no toilet paper. They, in fact, you were considered rather sophisticated if you could find some dried leaves or wet moss to wipe your bottom. If you were the king, well, that's different. Then you actually employed someone to wipe your bottom for you. The position of royal bun wiper. was officially called the Groom of the Stool. The more former title would be read, the Groom of the King's Close Stool to the King, and whatever the King's name is. So could you imagine every time the King went, they would announce that the King's stool person had to come and to assist him. And of course, they wouldn't have toilet paper, but they might have some cloth. And then that would be taken outside and thrown someplace, and nobody washed their hands. Ever. Nobody. Nobody brushed their teeth. Could you imagine the infections in your gums, how bad everyone's breath smelt? Nobody bathed. And fire was a constant fear of dwellers in the closely packed wooded houses and adequate water supply. Fires were difficult to control and could produce widespread damage. But then you had, when you weren't thinking about all this and smelling all this, 24/7, beds were of straw and were commonly kept close to an open hearth for warmth. But the straw was no good because it had lice. So everybody had lice. And if you were of royalty, you had to shave your heads. And therefore, you had to have enough money and influence to have your own weaver of royal hair. So they would make wigs, and they would powder the wigs. And then they would powder the face, and frequently they would use a lead-based paint or powder, and you would smell the high heavens. You would look like a freak show today by any, if you went to court. But just people walking up and down the streets, they didn't care about that unless they were the mercantile class. But again, lice was everywhere, absolutely everywhere, because it was in the beds. The roofs of reeds and rushes and straw were common. In 1213, these were the materials that they didn't want to use because they knew that they would be combustible, so they wanted shingles and tiles. In fact, King James VI of Scotland was called one of the wisest fools in Christendom. The king wore the same clothes for months on end. He slept in his clothes. He'd wake up in the morning, he'd be in the same clothes. He would just pull down his pants where the royal stool man would be, or he might have some commodes around, and he would sit on a commode that only the king could sit on and go into a little bucket, and when he got up, then all that would be taken outside and thrown away. And he wore the same hat 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, until it basically fell apart. He refused to wash or bathe because he was convinced it was bad for his health. And from the 13th century, there were public baths. The water was heated from the log fires nearby and carried by servants to a tub. However, the downside was that the buildings frequently caught fire and usually burned down a lot of other structures around them. And poor people bathed in cold water. They couldn't afford to have this. And those who could bathe generally bathe in the spring once, one time. They would have to use the same water in the same house, generally from a river or a lake, carried it to their house, ice cold and not clean. The oldest male, then the next oldest male, then right down to the oldest women, and then finally the baby. And that's why the term, don't throw the baby out with the bathwater. By that time, if you were one of the lower ends in the family, you were bathing in really dirty water. A large source of infection was bites from fleas and body lice. The poor people were very susceptible due to diet and malnutrition, and the human flea is capable of spreading diseases like typhus and parasites such as tapeworms. Another source of infection was the use of rushes or straw on the floors. The rushes were prone to dirt and filth in the eating halls, within houses, even in castles. Even in castles, they were filthy. The daily life of the nobles started at dawn. There would be mass, would be heard, and prayers given. Then the first meal of the day was breakfast, and the lords and nobles would attend to business matters in relationship to their land and finances and rents and taxes and customs and dues. And then they would exercise their judicial powers over their vassals and peasants. And then complaints and disputes regarding tenants would be settled and permission to marry, etc. Then they'd have weapons practice for about a half hour. And then in mid-morning, they'd have more prayers, another meal. And in the afternoon, the daily life turned to hunting, generally hawking or inspecting the estate. An evening prayer and then supper in the hall of the castle or the manor house. And after supper, then if you were rich or part of the court, you'd have music and dancing and jugglers and acrobats and jesters. And then before bed, you'd have your bedtime prayers. Oh, by the way, every night the music was the same, the dancing was the same. Imagine how monotonous that got. But look at the daily life of a peasant by comparison. I'm only talking about England now. You work in the fields or in the land started by dawn, and the daily life of a peasant, including reaping, sowing, plowing, binding, and thatching, haymaking, and threshing. The peasants made some of their own tools and utensils using wood and leather and the horns of cattle. And women generally ate when their husband and children had finished and had a little leisure time. And for breakfast, if you were nobility, well, this was eaten between 6 and 7 a.m., leisurely. A lord might have white bread, 3 meat dishes, 3 fish dishes, and you'd have more fish on saint days and wine or an ale to drink. But if you were a common person, this was eaten at sunrise. Generally, you'd have some dark bread, probably rye, with some ale. Now, lunch, if you were nobility, this was eaten between 11 in the morning and 12 to 2, and you'd have 3 courses again. But each course might have been between 4 to 6 courses in themselves. So if one of the courses was cheese, you might have 4 different types of cheese. If it was meat, you might have 4 different types of meat. And there'd be meat and fish on offer with wine and ale, and it's likely that only a small parts of each dish were actually eaten, with the rest being thrown away. But the kitchen staff generally worked together. The servants would then take the stuff home for themselves when the Lord wasn't looking. But if you were a common person, well, it was called a plowman's lunch, and you'd eat a dark bread with cheese. If you were lucky, maybe someone working with the Lord's house would get you some meat. But that was rare. And you also had a flask of ale to drink. Now, for supper, the nobility would eat around 6 to 7 in the evening. It'd be very similar to the lunch, but with slightly more unusual dishes, like you might have a pigeon pie or woodcock pie or sturgeon, which is a smelly fish, with wine and ale. But if you're an average peasant, you'd eat towards sunset, and that varied with the seasons. And the main meal would be vegetable pottage, whatever root vegetables were available, all thrown into a pot and boiled. And sometimes you would have some local fish caught, or maybe even some meat. You'd always have bread and ale. Well, that's just some of the things that would go on in a day. We have to understand that people were very basic. Their days almost never changed. Now, tomorrow, I'll talk about Versailles and the peasants who lived near it, who grew the food that was used there, the bureaucrats who maintained it, the aristocracy who made their life a life of leisure, and the royal court. I'll give you a position of both. I'll talk about their duties, what they did during a day, and what the heck do you do when it's 90 degrees out and you have to have all this clothes on, man or woman. You didn't have shorts. You couldn't dress light. You were boiling. There was no air conditioning and no fans. Plus, you had to have a wig on, and you had to have makeup on. Wow, and you had to stand there while the royals, the king and queen, were paraded in front of them almost 60 different dishes from which they would take a little kind of smidget. And you were not there to eat. You were there to watch them select what they were going to eat, and then you'd have a single dish. How did you get through that, and where did you go to the bathroom? Oh, I forgot. In the palaces, you could actually go in the stairwell? Yeah. And in the great hall? Absolutely. Wow. So you could be sitting at a table eating and just Whiz away. Wow. Why haven't we seen that portrayed? We have never seen anything coming close in any movie that I've seen that shows what life was like at different levels in society. So tomorrow, I'm going to talk about Henry XIV. I'm going to talk about China and the Middle East and what happens to the best and brightest, to the royals, and to the average person. I'm Gary Nall. Thank you for listening. Have a nice day.